How are we today, everybody?
Good.
Lovely. I asked the first service, there was just silence. Like, this is going to be fun today. Hey, my name's Charlie, if you didn't know. And today, before we jump into our text in John chapter 11 about a dude named Lazarus, I'm going to spend a couple minutes talking about Good Friday at CBC. If you haven't been before, Good Friday is one of my favorite things we do. And it's a space where we're allowed to kind of be creative. And so what it looks like, if you don't know, is we come together on Friday from 6:30 to 7:30, and we've set up about six or seven stations around this room. It's a worship labyrinth of sorts. If you're scared by the word labyrinth, don't be. It just means there's an idea and there's an action to help you figure out and connect with that idea. And so what we do is it's meant for people to, you can do it individually. It's kind of meant to be shared with family and with friends and with people around you. And it's a small teaching moment to get us on the same page. And then we just walk around the room and we think about what Jesus did on the cross. And there are church services that are supposed to make you feel all warm, fuzzy, and tingly. And those are beautiful because God gives joy. And there are church services that are supposed to feel like you got punched in the gut a little bit. That's Friday. Realistically, though, Friday is about what Christ did on the cross. Friday is about our sin. And what happens is we press into severity, to the severity and the seriousness of what sin actually is and what it means. The joy on Sunday is amplified. It's made richer and deeper. And so we take an hour-ish on Friday and we talk about what our sin meant. And we talk about the consequences of it. We have a theme every year. Last year, we talked about the different people around the cross. And as you walked around the room, you met each of these people. This year, our theme is just atonement. And so what we're going to talk about is the weight of sin, the effects of sin, the problem of sin, and then how God deals with sin. And it's going to be a really beautiful time. Actually, in the Jewish calendar, they have a day called the Day of Atonement. It's in the fall, and Jesus fulfills a lot of those, all of those things. And so we're going to do something a little different this year, too, and we'll send an email out tomorrow morning that walks through our Good Friday idea. But we're going to ask if you're comfortable with it, and if you're not, that's okay. On the Jewish calendar, when they have the Day of Atonement, they fast for the entire day. From sundown to sundown, we're just going to ask you to do it from that morning to that evening at dinner. Because when you fast and when you think about the pains of hunger, it makes us focus all the more on Christ's sacrifice and on his pain. It makes us focus on the severity of our sin and what it did. So we're going to ask that if you're willing to, fast with us that day. The staff's going to be doing it and praying through the day as we think about what Christ did on the cross. Now, this is not a legalistic church, so if you're like my wife and you're 5 months pregnant, eat some food, okay? I'm not telling my wife not to eat. That's going to go really poorly for me. So what we want to do is say, hey, if you're okay with it, fast for that day, and then we're going to come back together. And the idea is we'll break the fast with communion that night and then gather up in groups and go out to dinner somewhere and break the fast together and look forward to Sunday. So that's Good Friday. It's going to be amazing. I can't wait, guys. Today, we are in John chapter 11, and we're talking about a man named Lazarus. Let me give you a small spoiler alert. This is one of those sermons that's preached from when your kid is in preschool all the way up through, because it's a good story. And so, spoiler alert here, it ends with a dude not being dead anymore. Lazarus raising from the dead. But here's why I love this story is I think it's about, if you press into it, way more than just death to life. I think it's about way more than somebody that was dead and now he's alive. I think it's about way more than God just saying, look what I can do. There's a theologian, his name's Bart Ehrman. And he went to, like me, Moody Bible Institute. So, really smart guy. He went to Wheaton College like me. And then he went on, and where our paths diverge a bit is about 10 years after that, he started asking some tougher questions about suffering, and he realized that he just couldn't believe in God anymore. He's a professor of religion at University of North Carolina right now, writes a lot of books, really smart man. He loves the scriptures. He just doesn't believe they're special. He doesn't believe they're written by God because he doesn't believe in God. He had an interview last week I was listening to, and the interviewer said, was it a moment for you when you decided to stop believing, because this was your background, this was your schooling, you paid a lot of money to believe in Jesus. And he said, it really wasn't a moment as much as it was a culmination of a lot of little things. He said, I couldn't see how God is good and then see all the suffering around me all the time. From big things like genocide to little things like this guy got a job, which means this guy didn't, and how is God good in both those places? He said, I just couldn't, in my mind, get around a God that could work like that, and I couldn't see evidence of him in those spaces, so I just stopped believing. So here's what I bring that up is because I think today, the story of Lazarus, I think it's a story about God not showing up in the ways we think he will. What we're going to find is a guy that's really sick, and Jesus doesn't fix it right away. We're going to find a story of suffering and a story of pain and a story of emotion and a story of weeping. We're going to find all of those things in the same question this guy asks, I think we have to ask when we read this text, which is, where is God in all of this? Where is God when conflict comes about? Where is God when conflict arises in our story? That's the big question, I think, that Lazarus draws out of us. Last week, I brought up an author in a book, A Million Miles in a Thousand Years by Donald Miller. One of my favorite quotes just in life is a section in that book when he's talking about how do you write a good story, and he's talking about how we see good stories, and he's talking about pain and injustice, and he is talking about the nature of conflict in story, and he has this quote. He just was watching the news and saw a shooting, and he said, when we watch the news, we grieve all of these things, the pain, the injustice. But when we go out to the movies, we want more of it. Somehow we realize that great stories are told in conflict, but we're unwilling to embrace the potential greatness of the story we are actually in. We think God is unjust rather than a master storyteller. I love that because what it does is it challenges the perspective of where's God in suffering. It challenges me to say, what is God doing when I'm hurting and it seems like he's not showing up? Because if you look at John 11, just look in verse 1, we find a friend of Jesus who is in pain. Verse 1, now a certain man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village where Mary and her sister Martha lived. Now it was Mary who anointed the Lord and perfumed with his perfumed oil and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. Verse 3, so the sisters sent a message to Jesus, Lord, the one you love is sick. So today what we're going to do is, this is a very long story. We're not going to be able to run through it verse by verse. I'm going to pick some points that I really like and kind of tell where I think the tension is in the story. And it starts in verse 3, with him saying, Lord, look, the one you love is sick. And what we see is that Lazarus wasn't just a guy to Jesus. He wasn't just a random guy that Jesus met. He wasn't just somebody who touched Jesus' cloak as he walked by and wanted to be healed. Lazarus was someone that was special to Jesus because like you and me, Jesus had friends, right? This week, I needed something. Steve Hickson is in Colorado because he's got one good leg and he's somehow helping with the birth of a grandkid. I think he's probably hurting more than he's helping, but that's another discussion. And he is up there wheeling around, chasing around a two-year-old at this point, right? And I needed something from his house. So here's the deal. Steve does not give me a key to his home. and that's probably wise on his part. But I was talking to Andrea, and Andrea, one of our assistants, said, I have a key to his house. You want to get in there? I said, yes. So she gave it to me, which was great. And it got me thinking the closeness of the relationship of Jesus, Lazarus, Mary, and Martha. These are a bunch of single people that really liked each other, that had a great deep friendship. And I thought, you know, it's kind of like the people, if you look on your key rings, I have friends that have given me keys to their home. It's kind of like those people. Those people that you're okay if they come home one day and you're just hanging out in their living room eating their food, you know? They're like, oh, this made my day better. Not creepy, right? This is the kind of relationship Jesus has with these three. It is way more than just you're a friend of mine or we hung out a little bit. They are very, very close. Lazarus wasn't just a guy. He was someone Jesus loved and loved deeply. And so when they send the message, look, your friend, the person who you love is sick, what do you think Jesus would do? If it's me and someone I loved was in trouble or danger, I'm running towards them. Look at verse 6. We'll see how Jesus responds. So when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he remained in the city for 2 more days. It's not how I would respond. A couple years ago, it was like 3 or 4, I was driving home from work one Sunday. I think I taught that morning, and I was driving towards my house. I live in Dallas, and I was living with a buddy then. It was before I was married. And I was talking to my mom on the phone. She was probably telling me what I did wrong that day. I'm kidding. And as I'm driving, she walks back into her bedroom, and I'm never going to forget this. She just starts screaming, fire, fire, fire. I didn't know it then. My mom is deathly afraid of fire. And I guess she walked into her bedroom and something happened outside and the side of the house was on fire. And she starts yelling, "Fire, there's a fire." And I thought she was joking. It seemed out of the blue. When does fire ever give advance notice? But it was, you know, this moment when she starts screaming about it. She's yelling to my dad, "Bob, grab the dog. The house is on fire." And then all of a sudden she yells at me, "Charlie, call the fire department," hangs up the phone, right? And I was like, what just happened? So I drove home the speed limit. No, I don't need much of a reason to drive places more efficiently. But this gave me a justifiable cause to drive a little quicker towards Double Oak. I was on 635. I whip around and I start going, right? I don't know what my speed was, but it probably would have been like an A+ if it was a test. And I was driving, actually I got pulled over by a cop and he walks up to me, not in a good mood. And he said, "Do you know how fast you're running?" I said, "My parents' house is on fire." She's taking my head out the window. He said, "I don't care." I said, "Great, protect and serve." So he let me go and he was great about it. But long story short, when I heard my mom was in trouble, just the sound of her voice, the tone of her voice that something wasn't right, I was probably 25 minutes away and it didn't matter. I flipped that thing around and got there as quickly as possible because I cared. Jesus cares for these people. And in the middle of that, he waited 2 more days, right? Why? If somebody you love is sick and they say, "Hey, Jesus, this person is sick," and you have a reputation of healing people, when they say, "Please come and help," why do you wait? And so what I love about this passage up front, it brings up the issue of God's timing. It brings up the issue of when and how God chooses to respond to conflict and crisis. And that sometimes is difficult. Because he says, "I'm not going to do anything right now." And sometimes waiting is good. It never feels like it in the middle of conflict or crisis. But sometimes it's good for you because there's a bigger story out there and you don't see all of it. One of my best friend's kids, she's 18 months, I think, and she loves food. I know all babies love food. Well, most of them do. She now can walk, and so whenever he opens the fridge door, she hears it and sprints like a toddler does, so puts her head down and lets that lead towards the fridge, and she just starts wailing. And then when you shut the fridge door and she has not been fed, it is like she's a starving child in Africa, okay? And the crazy thing is, I was talking on the phone with him yesterday, and this was going on in the background. He's like, "Nora, you're going to be fine." He's like, "You're going to wait on your food because it's better for you." But in the moment, she can't see past that. That's what's going on right here, right now. Jesus sits there and he waits. He answers a question of why real quick. Go to 14 with me. It says, "Then Jesus told them plainly, 'Lazarus has died, and I'm glad for your sake I was not there so that you may believe. But let us go to him.'" So what God is saying, what Jesus is saying in this is that, yeah, Lazarus is sick and Lazarus has died, but I'm going to use it for something. You don't see it yet, you don't get my timing, but I'm gonna use it for your good, even though you don't get it. But it really brings up this idea of what is God doing in the middle? What is Jesus doing in the middle of crisis? Why does he wait? Because waiting's hard. That's the very kind of bedrock of our story. And then if you go back to verse 4 with me, it's one of my favorite verses in it. It says, "When Jesus heard this, he said, 'The sickness will not lead to death, but to God's glory, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it.'" And just really an important side note here. I think it not only brings up the idea of Jesus' timing, but also God's design a little bit in suffering. And for too many times, I've heard people say that God causes these things so that he can do something. But I think that's really unfair and uncharacteristic of a good God. So when it says, it's just an important note, when it says the sickness will not lead to death, but God's glory, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it, we have to note something, that Lazarus was not sick and did not die because God needed to prove himself. Lazarus was sick and he died because we live in a broken world, the world that Jesus is walking in. Constable said it well, he's a theologian. He said, "Sin does lie behind all suffering and evil in the world, but the connection between sin and suffering is not always immediate or observable." There's a New York Times article was written a few weeks ago that I read. It was really good. It was about a seminary professor at Duke, and she has cancer, and it's pretty terminal. She's getting checked every 3 months now. She's had it for about 2 years. I think it's stage 4 colon cancer. And she just writes about how to respond in the middle of that, like to her friends and family and people. And she said there's three kinds of responses normally to her sickness. And she said there are people that try to minimize it by saying, "Hey, you know, it could be worse. She said, there are people that try to teach through it. They try to sit there and say, well, this is why God is doing this to you. And her response is really great. She just talks about how, why would I believe in a good God if God needs to show me courage by giving me cancer? I have a four-year-old, you know? And so it's important that we stop down and realize that in the middle of this story, there is an intrinsic evil that is death that's happening. And it's spreading mourning all around the people that are touched by it. But God did not cause that. And so when it says that the Son of God will be glorified through it, this is what God does with injustice. He is not the cause of it, but he steps in the middle of it. And because he's bigger than it, he brings good from a place where good was not before. So because evil existed, Jesus says, I will step into the middle of it and bring about something that's beautiful because there was nothing that was beautiful. God did not cause Lazarus to be sick. He stepped in the middle of it and saved. It's a really important note. Because when we're in conflict, when it emerges in whatever story we're living out, when that happens, one of our first responses is, where is Jesus? Why is he not here? And then why did God do this? And I think it's a misappropriation of God's character, and it's a misappropriation of the world that we live in, of why injustice happens in the first place. But these guys didn't get it. The disciples didn't get it. Mary and Martha, who we're going to go to in a sec, didn't get it. Lazarus, I don't know if he got it or not. Dude's been dead for a little while. So what happens with the disciples, as we keep going in our story, is Jesus says, if you skip down with me, verse 14, 15, 16, he says, let's go to him at the end of verse 15. So Thomas, called Didymus, said to his fellow disciples, let us go too, so that we may die with him. I love that phrase. I totally forgot it was in here when I was reading this week. And what that does, it's a pretty big cultural indicator of the context that Jesus was living in. So up to this point, we've talked about as Jesus has progressed in kind of his following, as he's started to heal people more and more, starts rubbing the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the religious elite the wrong way. The way he talks about God, they think, is abhorrent. The way he equates himself with God, they think, is worthy of death. But really, his popularity as it rose and rose and rose is what killed him. And so up until now, right before this actually, he did a miracle, and you start seeing people for the first time plot against Jesus to kill him. It was very, very, very unsafe. Bethany, where they're going, is about a mile and three quarters-ish, just under 2 miles from Jerusalem, which is the hotbed, the epicenter of the religious elite. It's the most dangerous place for him to go. So the disciples are looking at this moment saying, man, Lazarus died, that's so sad, but we're not going to go anywhere around there. And then when Jesus says, guys, we're going to go in there, his disciples say, What are you doing? Do you know that we're going to die if we go there? Do you get that, that we're about to die if we walk into that place? They completely miss what Jesus is doing. They're looking out for their rabbi. They're looking out for themselves. And so when Jesus says, let's walk into Jerusalem a couple days, or right next to it, a couple days before the Passover, but a week and a half before he ended up being crucified, they understand the risks, and so does Jesus. And so Thomas, who gets a bad rap because he doubted one time, Thomas is an all-in guy. When he doubts big, and when he presses in hard. So when Jesus says, let's go to Bethany, and he knew that Jesus' life was on the line, and probably his followers, Thomas does not look at it and say, well, hey, we might be okay, guys. He says, we're all gonna die, you know? It's like in Armageddon, we've seen that movie, Steve Buscemi's on, like, he's mounting the tie him into a seat, and he gets a front row seat of the end of the world. It's that moment, like, well, let's die together, rah, rah, let's go. Love Thomas in this text. And so they march on. They march on to Bethany, and in verse 17, they get there, and we see Mary and Martha, two sisters. Now let's read for a little while, verse 17. When Jesus arrived, he found that Lazarus had been in the tomb for 4 days already. So even if Jesus left right away, Lazarus still would have been dead for 2 days when he got there. Now Bethany, verse 18, was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem. So many of the Jewish people of the region had come to Mary and Martha to console them over the loss of their brother. So when Martha had heard Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him. But Mary was sitting in the house. Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that whatever you ask from God, God will grant you. Jesus replied, your brother will come back to life again. And Martha said, I know he'll come back to life again in the resurrection of the last day. So I relate to Martha well. Martha's a rationalizer. Martha is one of these people that thinks before she acts. She plays out all the contingency plans and she tries to make an answer for everything. So when she walks up to Jesus and says, you could have stopped this, and she says after, but I know that God listens to you still. What she's saying there is, I still have faith in who you are. Like, I know you could have stopped this, but I've thought it through and I still believe in who you are. I trust that, you know, you're still a great teacher, and I trust that you're special. I'm just working this out in my head. She's trying to rationalize why things happen when they happen. Last night, I was at dinner at Bun and Brenda Baker's, and Nick and Rachel, youth pastor and his wife, Rich sang today, and Andy and Jamie and I were over there with me and Sarah. And we started sitting around the outdoor space, because it was a beautiful night at the end. We just started talking about Crossroads and how we got here. And one of them, I think somebody brought up the fact that I feel called to the ministry. And by called, I mean I have a moment in my life when I feel like God said, you're going to be a pastor. I can tell you all about it one time. Like time, place, all that stuff. It's a very specific call. That's why I'm still doing this gig, you know? And I remember Andy, whom I've known for a long time, looked at me and said, I didn't know that. And I said, yeah. And so he asked me about it, and I told him about it. And then, you know, we talked about one of the stories I told last week about how God steps in and provides for us in ways that sometimes we can't explain any other way, but God's showing up. And then Andy told me a story or two that's going on in his life about moments when God has clearly stepped in and provided. And we're both Marthas. We're both rationalizers. So we sat there and tried to figure out another way. Like, there's got to be an explanation for this. What did I have to eat on the Tuesday I got called into ministry? Maybe it was Taco Bell. It had to be bad beans. You know, like there has to be a reason for this seeming thing to happen. And we walked through and, you know, sometimes we could point it out. And sometimes we just had to sit back and say, I don't know what it is yet, but I'm going to find it. You know, it is not easy for us to believe that something bigger happens. We are both rationalizers. That is Martha. That's why when Jesus says that he will rise again, Martha responds with, I know. He will come back to life again in the resurrection of the last day. So real quick, the idea of resurrection wasn't a concept that was brought about by Jesus. Lots of faiths have resurrection. The Jews before Jesus had and still have an idea of resurrection. And why is simply because we realize there's conflict in our stories. What resurrection stands for in just about every faith or religion, it stands for the idea or belief that tomorrow's pain goes away and that there's betterment out there. This is in the end. That this conflict, that this struggle is in the end. That's why when we talk about resurrection, it's a happy thing when we see the people that follow Jesus that we love when they pass on. We talk about resurrection in ways that say there will be no more sickness and no more healing. Because resurrection at its core is hopeful. It's us collectively coming together as Christians or as Jewish men and women or as other religions and saying, you know what? There has got to be a hope beyond the injustice I see in front of me. Resurrection at its core is about tomorrow is being better than today. It's an answer for the conflict in our stories. And it was in the Jewish faith as well. In Daniel 12, Martha's responding, saying, yeah, I know there's a resurrection in the last day. She gets it from two verses. Daniel 12, multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. The Jews thought they would awake to life. And then in Isaiah 26, but your dead will live, Lord, their bodies will rise. Let those who dwell in the dust wake up and shout for joy. Your dew is like the dew of the morning. The earth will give birth to her dead. So this idea of resurrection was one that the Jews knew and knew well. They understood that there was a hope beyond this one, a life beyond this one. They understood that there was something better to strive for. And so Martha responds, and she said, yeah, I know, I'm going to see him in the last day. And Jesus' answer in verse 25 is, no, I am the resurrection and I am the life. One of the I am statements in the book of John. And all those I am statements are Jesus saying, I am God, by the way. It's mirroring the Old Testament name for God in that statement, I am. And so what's happening is Jesus looks at Martha and says, I am the resurrection and the life, because she's pointing towards his future hope. Like, I know one day down the road, I will have a hope that tomorrow is better than today. And Jesus says, that's me. Constable's a theologian. He said he was questioning her faith in him, not her faith in doctrines. It's really easy to believe in something. It's way harder to believe it personally. It's really easy to know something. It's way harder to apply that knowledge to my day-to-day life and then depend on it as if it's real. I don't know if you guys saw it years and years ago, Good Will Hunting, I'm sure you have, one of the greats. There's a scene in that movie that popped in my head when I read this. It's at the end of the movie, and Matt Damon plays the main character, and Robin Williams is his counselor. And this kid is a genius, but he's troubled because his dad beat him up quite a bit when he was growing up. And this scene, which is all ad-lib, by the way, which is beautiful, is Matt Damon has all the answers because he's smarter than everybody in the whole movie. He's smarter than his counselor. And Robin Williams looks at him and says, hey, you know, this isn't your fault. And Matt Damon says, yeah, I know. It's not my fault. My dad hit me. And then Robin Williams just keeps repeating it, right? It's a really beautiful scene. He says, hey, this isn't your fault. And Matt Damon says, yeah, I know. Over and over and over again, Robin Williams says, this is not your fault. And over again, he says, I know. But with each passing time, you get this picture that it broke down from I know this to be true to I believe this to be true. And the scene ends with him weeping. And for the first time, I think he finally got the fact that it really wasn't his fault and started to change who he was, how he functioned. This is that moment for Martha who rationalizes everything. She says, I know there's a resurrection. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it too. It's great. I've read about it. I've studied it. I know the conditions around the resurrection. And Jesus says, you don't understand. I am that. And I'm standing right here. Believe in me and find life. One of my favorite commentators said, when you're sick, you want a doctor, not a medical book or a formula. When you're being sued, you want a lawyer, not a law book. Likewise, when you face your last enemy, death, you want the Savior and not a doctrine written in a book. In Jesus Christ, every doctrine is made personal. This is the moment when Martha takes doctrine and makes it personal. It's a beautiful picture of what he's doing. He's saying that hope that you have in this concept of resurrection is found right here, right now. Because what Jesus is doing is stepping into their conflict and saying there's hope in the middle of it, even if you don't see it. And she hadn't yet. And so then she takes Jesus to Mary because Mary wanted to see Jesus. Skip one through down to, I'll go to verse 28. It says, Martha went and called her sister Mary, saying privately, the teacher's here and asking for you. So when Mary heard this, she got up quickly and went. Jesus had not yet entered the village, but was still in the place where Martha had come out to meet him. Then the people who were with Mary in the house, consoling her, saw her get up and quickly go out, and they followed her, because they thought that she was going to the tomb to weep. What we see about Mary is the opposite of Martha. This is the woman who shortly before this took a year's worth of oil, so it was a bottle of oil that cost a year's wages, and dumped it on the feet of Jesus and wiped it up with her hair. This is an emotional, kind of creative, I'm gonna just leap into what I feel over what I think kind of woman. And so rightfully so, she is weeping uncontrollably and she leaves to go probably weep somewhere else. And she finds Jesus, and what she says is something I'd say, it's something Martha said, but you can tell that she feels it all the more. She says in verse 32, Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died. That phrase is hard, because if he really loved and cared for these people, what would you do for somebody you love who was in pain? This week, I moved into my first house on Saturday, yesterday, and I carried everything. And no, thanks. Some of you are looking at me like, I know that's not true. How are the pillows, Charlie? They're fine. Big pillows, heavy. Anyway, so I moved, and what I mean is somebody else moved, and then this week I spent painting the house. And again, when I say I worked on my car is I got a friend that's better at it than me, and then I claimed all the credit while I watched them. So Dylan and Andrea, two people on staff, came over to paint my house because I absolutely will show favoritism towards people who do personal favors for me. And they actually were gracious enough to come paint because my wife told me I was not allowed to, because she's seen me paint. And I'm more abstract. I just want to get the job done. So we're sitting there and we're painting and we're trying to get these two rooms done. And Sarah stops by after work, this on Tuesday, about 6:30. And we're about done with the first coats on everything. I don't paint. I don't know how long these things take. So we're talking about the end of the night. And I said, yeah, we shouldn't be home. It shouldn't be much longer, maybe an hour, hour and a half. So she says, great, I'm going to go pack the apartment and we'll just see you there tonight. We'll pack together. I said, sounds good. Well, it wasn't an hour and a half, because these things take a while, I guess. You have to let it dry for some reason before a second coat. I don't know. I was too busy taking credit. So we go and we wait, and I get them food, and we come back, and we put a second coat on, and it just drug out because it does. Had to retouch up trim, and so it's 10:45, and we're walking to the car, loading the stuff, and Andrea checks her phone, and she says, you need to call your wife. And I said, oh. I go check my phone, didn't know it. My phone had died. So I hadn't texted my wife or told my wife anything. And we're not really a let's check in every 5 minutes couple. That's not how we are, okay? And so I used Andrea's phone and I called her and she said, what is wrong with you? And I said, this didn't start well. And I said, we're just wrapping up painting. She said, I've called, I've texted friends. Like, you said you're gonna be home hours and hours ago. I didn't know if you were laying on the floor somewhere, you know, pass out. I said, no. And I could tell this was gonna be a longer conversation. So I said, let me just go home and see you there. And she said, okay, I'm gonna go home too. I said, where are you? She said, driving to see you. And I said, oh, this is worse than I thought. So I hung up the phone and got in my car, and I got in my car and plugged my phone into a little car charger. And as I'm driving home, I'm getting the text that she had sent, you know? And it was, hey, I thought you were gonna be home an hour ago. Hey, I thought you were gonna be home 2 hours ago. Hey, where are you, you know? And it was, hey, seriously, I'm kind of getting worried. You okay? Anything happening? And then it was, I'm gonna start to text our friends. You know, like this kind of sort of thing that she did. And with each passing text, I realized that I caused pain to my wife because I didn't respond. So I got home and we talked about it. And, you know, she's 5 months pregnant, and I just thought to myself, oh my God, I felt so badly because I would do anything, I really would, to stop pain from happening to the people I love. I felt terribly. Mary and Martha both looked at Jesus and said, you could have stopped this, but you weren't here. How badly do you think that guy felt because he loved these people? It had to be a gut punch. So Martha says to him, you couldn't stop, you could have stopped this and you weren't here. And then the next three verses are some of my favorites. I think this is kind of the climax, honestly, of the story, not necessarily the Lazarus walking out of the tomb thing. Because what happens in the next three verses, let's read them together and then we'll dive into it. It says in verse 33, when Jesus saw her weeping and the people who had come with her weeping, he was intensely moved in spirit and greatly distressed. He asked her, where have you laid him? They replied, Lord, come and see. And then verse 35 that we've all memorized to feel like better Christians because it's the shortest verse in the Bible, Jesus wept, you know. So what happens is you have really two big statements from Jesus. One, it says in verse 33 that Jesus was intensely moved, and then two, at the end of that, Jesus weeps. I want to know why he was moved and why he wept. There's a couple theories out there. One says, when it says intensely moved there, it's a tricky word to translate. In the Greek, it literally outside of biblical text, so in the first century world, it was used to describe when horses snort. You know, when they get kind of angry and frustrated and they snort. And when you apply that to a human, literally it means that he's angry. It means that he is indignant to the situation. So Jesus gets angry in this moment and then he weeps. And some people say, we got angry because they're making him do another miracle. But that really doesn't add up. Because one, over and over again, the Lord is compassionate and gracious, abundantly so. And so it doesn't make any sense that he does something compassionate and then gets mad about it. Two, it doesn't make any sense that he healed people all over the New Testament and he never once healed somebody. He's like, dang it, guys, I had other plans today. It is a joyful moment of God restoring every time. So he was always joyful after he healed people. Why would he be angry here? Thirdly, he loved Lazarus. Why would you not be even the more joyful out of somebody's life who you rescued that you loved? So when it says that he was indignant and he was angry, I think what you have to do is look at the context. I think that for 33 years almost at this point, he'd walked around and he'd seen pain and he'd seen brokenness. He'd seen injustice abound. And he comes to this climactic moment where it's his friends and it's his family and death is the ultimate injustice. And he looks at the effect that death has on his friends. He sees them all weeping. And I think he gets angry at it. I have a good family friend of mine who used to grew up with their family, lived in Flower Mound. And they were Pinterest before Pinterest existed. They make Chip and Joe look like amateurs. I'm not kidding. These people are amazing. It's one project after another project after another project. They're never visiting my house. And they loved their home. I remember going there as a kid. I remember walking in and being like, oh my gosh, new project after new project. Thing was beautiful. That was probably 15, 20 years ago. I remember 3 or 4 years ago, their oldest son came into town and we're friends. And so we said, you know what? Let's stop by your old house. Let's see how it's doing. You know, so we drove in Flower Mound. We drove up to this house and we were both blown away by it. We walked in the backyard and the thing was a dump. Where their pool was, it was just a hole that was now dirt and filled with trash. We took the liberty of letting ourselves in, and we walked through the house because clearly nobody was living there, and it was just completely trashed. And as we walked through it, step by step, room by room, we just kept saying, I can't believe this house is like this. Like the last time we saw it, it was beautiful and good and cared for. Okay, imagine Jesus makes the world, and then he comes back to it, and he walks around it for 33 years, and he says, this is not what I made. This is not how I wanted us to go. I think over time, what you see is Jesus get angrier and angrier at the consequences, the effects of sin. And I think in this moment, when he's face to face with death, when he's face to face with how this place is as opposed to what he created, I think he sees its consequences. He sees its effects. He sees the emotional toll that sin takes on people. He sees the conflict and the pain, and he gets mad at that. He's mad at it because this isn't how we're supposed to go. D.A. Carson said this, I love this quote. He said, grief and compassion without outrage reduced to mere sentiment. Well, outrage without grief hardens into self-righteousness, self-righteous arrogance or irascibility. What he's saying is, if you have grief and compassion, but you're not outraged by the injustice, then your grief and compassion are empty because you don't get it. But if you are outraged by it, but that's not met with compassion, then it's usually pretty hard. So Jesus comes into this moment. He sees the effects of sin on the world to his best friends. And I think that makes him angry. And then he follows that with this beautiful picture of crying. Because it's this perfect balance between I'm outraged by it, but I'm also saddened by it. That same woman that was sick, that wrote the article in the New York Times, said, you want to know the best response to my sickness? Sit with me, encourage me, cry with me. I just want compassion. I don't want a fixer. I don't want somebody that's going to teach me about it. I don't want somebody that's going to minimize it. I want somebody that's going to sit with me and encourage me and grieve with me. And so in Jesus in this moment, we see somebody that's outraged by the injustice, and we also see his very human response of tears because of what's happening all around him. Because he made a different world than this. And he's surrounded by this conflict, and he's saying, this isn't how it's supposed to be. I love this moment. Because it's this balance of Jesus saying, this is not what I have in mind, as he comes to kind of the end of his mission in this world. I love it because I need to believe in a God. I want to believe in a God who gets just as mad as injustice as I do, and he weeps with me too. And that's what the incarnation did. It's Jesus sitting with us in the middle of our pain. It's Jesus saying, yeah, I want to walk with you in it. And I think it's beautiful to know that we follow a God who doesn't just weep with us, but he's outraged by it. And then the rest of the story, and this week and next week, as we talk about resurrection in two different ways, God says, but this is also why I came. I came because I'm not just going to get mad at it, and I'm not just going to sit there with it. I'm actually going to do something about it. And that's the end of our story. And I'm just going to read this as a chunk, verse 38. Jesus intensely moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and the stone was placed across it. Jesus said, take the stone away. Martha, the sister of the deceased, replied, Lord, by this time the body will have a bad smell because it had been buried for 4 days. And Jesus responded, didn't I tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? So they took away a stone. Jesus looked upward and said, Father, thank you that you've listened to me. I know that you always have listened to me, but I said this for the sake of the crowd standing around here, that they may believe and know that you sent me. When he said this, he shouted in a voice and said, Lazarus, come out. The one who had died came out, his feet and hands tied up with strips of cloth and a cloth wrapped around his face. Jesus said to them, unwrap him and let it go. I love this story because I think it's more than just a guy walking out of a tomb. I think this story at its very core is Jesus saying, I am fed up with the world with the conflict in the world that I created good. And he's looking at the cross, which is a week away, and he's saying, I came here to do something about it. I love this story because it shows me that Jesus sits with our pain, gets mad at our pain, and says, I'm going to fix the pain. I love this story because to me it's so much more than just Jesus proving that he can raise people from the dead. I love this story because it goes back to the fact of us asking the question, where is God when we have pain? Because nobody got it, you know? The disciples didn't get it at the very beginning. Martha didn't get it as he talked about the resurrection. Mary didn't get it as she was just really sad. Lazarus, I don't know what was happening. He was probably pretty angry, actually. Like, can I go back? That was not that bad, you know? But really what the story does is it changes as you see next week in light of this week, which is always hard to do. It changes our perspective on things. So I'm betting as the weeks unfolded, the week after this one and the one after that, that every time they look back, they saw something different than they realized in the moment. What they're doing is realizing that God's telling a better story than theirs. I was at Christmas, I was up in the mountains with some families from CBC, and I don't know if you guys ever had the Where's Waldo books as a kid. I used to love those things. And one of the kids got a Where's Waldo book. I haven't looked at those things in like 20 years. So I'm sitting on the couch with these two kids, 8, 9-ish, and we're going through this Where's Waldo book. And look, I'm still competitive. I want to win, okay? I'm trying to like nurture, like, God, let's find it together. But I'm really like shielding some of the, you know, I'm going to work on that with my kid. But we're looking through it, can't find it, the first page. It took like 10 minutes, 12 minutes, 15 minutes, and I'm not moving on until I get this one. We finally found it. What was amazing to me was that after you see where that little character is on the page amongst all these other red striped things on the page, no matter what, I can't look at that page and not see Waldo anymore. It completely, once you've seen it, when it makes sense, once you know where it is, it completely changes your perspective on everything else. This is what happens with this story for these four people, these four groups of people. I think the question we ask in the middle of conflict, in the middle of pain, is where is Jesus? And I think God's saying, I'm telling a bigger story, it's just not done yet. And next week, we're going to talk about what Jesus' resurrection did and how it informs our yesterday and how we look back and say, oh, wait, that's what God was doing. He was angry at the pain. He sat with me through the pain, and then he came to fix the pain. So I think that the resurrection of Lazarus is about God writing a better story where death is replaced by life, tears are replaced by joy, and where Jesus reminds us that he is the hope we long for when we think of resurrection, because resurrection is hopeful. And what he's doing here is saying, it's enough. It's enough. I'm the resurrection and I'm the life. And with that comes so much more than just I rose from the dead or Lazarus rises from the dead. With that comes a whole idea of what Jesus is doing through and in his people. And they might not have got it yet, but I guarantee you they looked back and did. Because this story is one of hope. It's one of compassion. And it's one of God saying, I'm changing things. I'm writing a better story. Trust me and join me. Let me pray for us and we're gonna end in some worship. God, I'm thankful for your perspective and your bigness. I'm thankful, God, that you are good, even when I can't see it right in front of me. I'm thankful that you continue to show up in ways that I don't expect. God, I pray as we go back to some worship that we just start thinking about the ways that maybe you've shown up in our lives where we didn't notice it at first. I pray that through this text, we hopefully have gotten a bigger picture of the compassion of Jesus and the power of Jesus and the love of Jesus and the anger of Christ at what happened to his good creation. I pray that through this story, we see that God just didn't come to suffer with us, but to do something about it. He came to write a better story in the middle of this one. May we believe that. May it cause us to worship. May it cause us to see Jesus in a different light. May it cause us to inspire hope, because that's what you meant when you said, I am the resurrection, that we have hope in life where there was none. And I pray all these things in the name of Jesus. Amen.